I'm delighted to have with me today Simon Elmer, author and co-founder of Architects for Social Housing and its head of research. Simon, you've been a vocal critic of the response by virtually all governments around the world to the alleged coronavirus pandemic over the past 32 months, writing extensively about the subject through Architects for Social Housing, as well as your Twitter page. You've recently collated much of your work on the coronavirus measures forced upon humanity by international technocracies into a book, which you recently published at the end of September 2022. The book is an absolute must for anyone who wishes to understand the mechanisms at work behind the undeclared war being waged and concealed by the cloak of an emergency health crisis. Before we talk about the book, tell us a bit about yourself and how Architects for Social Housing, also known as ASH, came about. You also hold a PhD from University College London. Tell us about your academic background.
I got a PhD from University College London in the history and theory of art. And the period I studied, taught, was between the two world wars, so the 20s and 30s. That was my sort of historical period, which has turned out to be very useful in terms of the kind of repetition of that period now. And I taught for about 10 years in the UK and also in the US. And then in 2015, I co-founded the company that I'm co-director of, which is Architects for Social Housing. We're a community interest company and an architectural practice. And we propose design alternatives to the demolition program. It's a program in the UK to demolish council housing and to replace it with market sale housing. And through that, I'm the head of research for our company because we realised we had to not only propose design alternatives, but also policy alternatives as well. So I come out of a research background. And in March 2020, when lockdown was imposed, I began to research the policy that was being imposed on us, that was just stripping us of our human rights. So there's a continuation of analysing government policy and writing about it. And that's the sort of the continuity between the three. And just recently, I've published a book called The Road to Fascism for a critique of the global biosecurity state, which is why I'm here talking to Ash.
Prior to the events of the past 2.5 years, did you have any political leanings, and have those changed with the expiry earlier this year of the Coronavirus Act?
I don't really like using labels because it gives people a reason not to read you or to listen to you of either side. I think anyone who reads my stuff will have a fairly good idea of where I am in that kind of window of stuff. Just recently today, I've got an article appearing in The Conservative Woman. And if I'd said to my friends 3 years ago, before this happened, that I was publishing in The Conservative Woman, they would have laughed at me. They probably might do now still. The Conservative Woman has actually been one of the very few, I guess, journals or online media platforms which has published criticisms of what's been going on and questions and so on and so forth. So I'm very proud to publish an article in it. And I said to the editor, I really admired the fact that even though her readership is going to be conservative with a small c, that didn't stop her from publishing my article. And I said to her, and she agreed with this, that this really redundant opposition between left and right, which of course comes out of the French Revolution 230 years ago, it's a very, very old opposition, simply doesn't describe contemporary politics. And I think it's used to divide us against each other and also to encourage compliance with the global biosecurity state. Those are the terms which describe our contemporary politics, that we have a global government forming in which national governments are merely implementing its directives, and that the new ideology is not left-wing or right-wing, it's biosecurity. And these are the regulations, restrictions, ideologies and ways of thinking which is determining contemporary politics. Left and right has no descriptive purchase on contemporary politics, which is a way of me saying, no, I'm not going to tell you where I am.
In your book, The Road to Fascism, you talk at great length about the global biosecurity state that we now find ourselves in. Can you describe what that is? And are there any historic parallels of such a state that we can look back at in order to compare and contrast a situation from our past with recent events that continue to unfold before our very eyes?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a key one, I think. The term biopower was introduced by a French philosopher called Michel Foucault, who died in the 80s, and he wrote most of his books in the 70s, really. And he wanted to add something to a kind of a critique of power, which understands power being manifested through economic power, through political power or through legal power, which is a more traditional sort of Marxist critique of societies. He came up with this idea that for a long time now in the West, power has been manifested through what he calls discourses. A discourse isn't simply a way of speaking or a framework of speaking. It's a set of ideas which have institutional backing. So there is a discourse of medicine. There is a discourse of policing. There's a discourse of prisons and what they're meant to do. There's a discourse of race. There's a discourse of gender. There's a discourse of sexuality. These are all discourses. He analysed things like, how do prisons work historically? How do medical clinics work? So he wanted to understand how we've moved from power being merely about enforcing what we can and cannot do. The law, at its most simple, says, if you do that, you have broken the law, and we will arrest you and we will punish you. And in the old days, back in the medieval times, the sovereign had the power to take your life if you'd broken his law, the sovereign's law. And Foucault said the new forms of power are not about saying you cannot do this, purely having a negative function, but had a positive function. Positive in the sense that their concern was how we can survey, monitor, control, direct, measure, and regulate our lives. So it's not simply punitive, it's actually about controlling us. You can see already this is a very useful way of thinking, kind of concept of biopower to understand what's happening at the moment. The new programs which are being initially promoted under lockdown, masking, enforced vaccination, being locked at home, tracking us everywhere we go. These are ways in which the state is trying to monitor our biological cells. And the new programs which are about to be implemented, like digital ID, are going to take that to another level. And the key thing about biopower is it accords the state both the right and the duty to take into care the biological body of the population, both its right and its duty. And it comes in and it says, as we're saying now, humans are born with an insufficient biology. Somehow you are born into sin. It's a kind of a religious idea. The idea that we are born and we are already a danger to ourselves and others because we are potential conveyors of disease. So therefore we're going to vaccinate you. So even from the moment we're born now, the state is saying we're going to take possession of your biological existence. We're going to monitor it and we're going to control it and perfect it and change it. That's what biopower is about. And the other philosopher who's influenced me is Giorgio Agamben, the contemporary Italian philosopher, who has taken up Foucault's idea and looked at what happens when biopower becomes the explicit strategy of contemporary politics. So for him, he says that our biological cells, what he calls our bare life out of any human rights, any democratic accountability, is increasingly the object of political strategies across the world. And these seem to me to be ways in which we can understand what's going on outside of the kind of hysteria around we're threatened with a disease or global warming. That actually what's going on is our political states are trying to take rights and possession over our biological selves. And that's why this coup, if you want to call it, this globalist coup, has been initiated and is being pursued around a discourse of disease.
What enabled you to come to the realization that the COVID-19 health crisis wasn't about governments protecting us from ourselves, but was something far more diabolical?
As I said before, I've got a background of reading housing policy. And you might think, people sort of say, how did you get from housing policy to this? It's actually not very different. Housing policy is written to accommodate the flow of global capital into specific national states. And housing policy is written to accommodate capital and to create a crisis. The housing crisis is created by housing policy, not addressed by it. So, as I said before, when this huge wave of policy, of regulations, coronavirus-justified regulations were made, I think they've made, in 2 years, they made 582 separate statutory instruments which were coronavirus-justified. And each statutory instrument contained, 10, 12, 20 regulations. So we're talking about thousands of regulations, almost every single one of which took away part of our freedoms and our rights. So when I started to read these, I had the background to understand how to read them because they're legal documents. They're quite difficult to understand. And then I started looking at something I hadn't looked at before, which was the sort of the Office of National Statistics, their publishing of what was actually going on at the actual mortality rates, the actual infection fatality rates and all this sort of stuff, and other sources like the NHS and so on. And there was simply no correspondence between them. There was no correspondence between this invented pandemic, or should I say, an invented crisis. There never has been, and there isn't, a threat to public health, which is written on every single regulation that's been made over the last 2 years, and which was made without oversight or scrutiny or approval by Parliament. For 2 years, we were ruled by decree, by ministerial decree. And so looking at the statistics, the data that was coming out of the statisticians and the medical industry, and looking at the regulations done on the back of it, there was no correspondence between it. And that's really what made me suspicious from the start.
So what you're saying is that the various institutions of the state responsible for the statistics or data weren't hiding any of the information, which suggests there wasn't a pandemic, if anyone cared to look.
It's not simply looking at the data, it's also looking at what the criteria were by which that data was produced. And one of the earliest articles I wrote, which kind of did well, and I think maybe that's how you met me, was one called Manufacturing Consensus. And I looked specifically at what qualifies a death for being recorded as a COVID death, a COVID-19 death. By researching this, I looked through the kind of legislative changes to disease taxonomy, to how deaths were recorded, how infection with SARS-CoV-2, so coronavirus disease, was established, how a death was recorded on death certificates, a whole set of criteria which had all been changed in a very short period of time, like a month. And it was this that was producing a pandemic out of something which was simply wasn't there. The statistics were hard to read because you had to also look at the framework by which those statistics were being produced. And what happened, what became very clear, is that, as often happens, the data was producing what the criteria for producing the data wanted to produce. A bit like the PCR tests. If you use PCR tests, and that's what the guy who invented it says, if you increase its cycle thresholds of amplification, you can find anything. I think what a lot of people don't know is that every time the cycle gets increased, it gets increased exponentially. So at 28 cycles, you can actually record infectious virus. That's about 16 million. The level it's being used at, which is accepted as a positive rate, is 40, which is over 1 trillion. So the difference between 28 and 40 cycles, it doesn't seem that much. It's absolutely enormous. A trillion cycles of amplification, saying that's nothing. That could be what's in the air around you or something. So when I began to realise that these sort of changes to the way something as fundamental as you're either infected or not was absolutely meaningless, then I began to smell a rat, like a lot of other people did.
One of the things that struck me about your book was your criticism of governments around the world making unfounded claims of how we were living in unprecedented times and so required unprecedented measures as a consequence. It sounded as though this was stated in order to provide an alibi for these governments to carry out a systematic demolition of our way of life simply because we were at a moment about which history could teach us nothing. The claim about the unprecedented nature of the alleged pandemic is just one of the important themes of the book. Could you tell us in your own words what the book is about?
I'm an art historian. That's my training. I don't do that now. But I'm trained as a historian. And whenever people in power say that this is unprecedented and that we've never done this before and the past can tell us nothing about this, they're lying. They're doing it because they want you not to think about this as, have we had this before? And we were told right from the start that the only model of this was the so-called Spanish flu, as it's incorrectly called, which was right after the Great War of 1914 to 1918. And figures were bandied around that, you know, 50 million people would die and so on and so forth. And we were also told that the measures that were being taken, the so-called medical measures like lockdown, had never been used before. And that the fact that we were making huge swathes of legislation under emergency powers had never been done before. Oh, we have to do it this way because this is an unprecedented situation. These are all lies. Emergency powers have been used throughout British history and European history. They're used all the time in Italy. France has been under a state of emergency, particularly in relation to the Gilets Jaunes protests, for many, many years before this. So I thought it was important to go back and look at what the precedents for this were, legally, medically, and in terms of the way that governments are behaving as well. What precedents can we, in the past, have governments taken away human rights on the justification of a emergency situation in redressing a threat to the state and the people in it. And unsurprisingly, I went back to the 1920s and the 1930s, which is that period when the whole of Europe was run. You know, the Third Reich was run under a state of emergency between 1933, when the Nazi Party got into power, and 1945, when it was defeated in the Second World War. And the same thing happened in Italy and so on. So these were the precedents that I began to look at because of my own background interest in that period. I saw a lot of parallels straight away. So in terms of the way the governments were behaving, in terms of the way legislation was being made and what it was doing to us, stripping us of our rights, but also in other terms, like the deliberate creating of fear and the effects it was have, the way it was turning people against each other, the way we were creating a, as fascist governments always do, creating a kind of an enemy within. We had two enemies within. We had the unvaccinated. Before that, we had the unmasked. In between, we had the people who wouldn't stay at home in lockdown, of which I was one. But we also became ourselves. We became threats to ourselves. We were told, you know, kids were told that they were killing granny if they kind of went out and stuff. So it was creating a lot of internal hatred, fear, anger against ourselves as a body politic. And that, again, is something that fascism did. For a long time, the first 2 years, every now and then, every few months, I would kind of move away from analysis of statistics and figures and data and so on and try to answer a question about, well, where is this going? Because people say, well, OK, if you're right, Simon, if you and other people are right about this, to what ends is this being done? And when I made some efforts to do that, I very deliberately didn't use the word fascism because it's such a loaded term. And if you use it, it's usually used as simply as an insult. Say you're a fascist or something, particularly anarchists and people on the left, you know, if they don't like what you're doing, they say you're a fascist or whatever. It's kind of a childish thing. And if you use it as a term, you're not taken seriously. So I didn't use it for a long time. I didn't think it was appropriate. But eventually, I think during the winter, the last winter, what was going on in the world, the kind of the extraordinary level of violence of these police and paramilitaries in Canada, in France, in Austria, where you actually had people told that they couldn't leave their home if they weren't vaccinated. And if the police caught them, they would be fined huge figures, thousands of euros. And if they didn't pay those fines, they would go to prison. And I was like, thinking, gosh, you know, in Germany, you had kids being told they had to go to the front of the class and explain every day why they had been vaccinated. In Lithuania, they were one of the first to sort of have this, you know, kind of blanket mandates on vaccination. You had places like Australia, New Zealand, which are typically seen as kind of very liberal societies, which had extraordinary levels of violence. You know, on the streets of Melbourne, you had police running around in armoured cars with God knows what weapons on top, sort of shooting people with rubber bullets. So, and I thought, well, if this isn't fascism, what is it? So when I started to write my book, I thought, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this word and I'm going to see, I'm going to examine in the book what, not whether this is fascism, that's a kind of an academic question about terminology. And people always come back to me and say, well, that's not fascism because fascism is this. There's as many different definitions of fascism as there are people almost. Not quite, but there's hundreds of them. And there are thousands of books written about it. That's not my question. It's not an academic book. What I want to ask is, what can historical fascism, this period in the 20s and 30s in Europe, tell us about what's going on now, politically, ideologically, legally, etc.? And obviously, because I wrote a book about that, I found that it can tell us an enormous amount about it. And finally, it's a warning. It's a warning to people. Although, you know, because we still think in our sort of circles, we've got some perception of what's going on, and we're very, very worried, to put it mildly, about what's happening. But there's a lot of people out there who think this is over. And even if they think, oh, maybe the government was a little bit too zealous. Maybe they shouldn't have fired care workers for not taking compulsory medical, you know, injections and so on. I think there's still not enough awareness about what's coming next, what digital ID and central bank digital currency are going to enable. So it also works as a warning that we are on the road to fascism and where that can possibly take us.
In the book, you talk at great length about the parallels between the rise of fascism in the 1920s and 30s, which of course led to the Second World War, and the current war being waged against humanity, ostensibly sold as fighting a deadly, civilization-threatening, novel disease. One of the key differences between then and now is that there was a Red Army that came to save the people from the wrath of the Nazis. This time round, the war is being fought not against any foreign nations, but against populations by their own member states. There's no sign of any foreign country coming to save us using military or any other kind of force. To compound matters, most of the global population are unaware that the war is being waged upon them rather than an invisible enemy. What are your thoughts on the precarious situation those of us who can see what's happening find ourselves in, and how the attack on humanity is, for the vast majority, still hidden in plain sight?
It has parallels with what happened in the 20s and 30s, but the historical situation is very different in a way. Europe is a different place. Historical fascism rose out of a number of things, but one of the things it rose out of is the aftermath of the Great War and the desire of Italy and Germany in particular to open up areas of the world to colonisation in the same way that the UK had, that the US had, that France had, even Belgium and Holland and so on had. They all had their colonies, they all had their empires. Germany and Italy didn't. So when it evolved as a battle between imperial nations. That's the way Europe hasn't been like that for a long time now. Europe now is a super bloc itself. And beyond that, the West is a kind of a super bloc. As we can see at the moment, the battle between nations is a battle between the West and the East. That's what's going on with this kind of proxy war with Russia. And in the kind of very strange sort of relationship we have with China at the moment in the West. So what we're facing now is not national leaders, Führers and Duces and all that sort of stuff. The great leadership now is things like the European Commission, the World Economic Forum, the World Health Organization, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank. These technocratic forms of global governance, whose directors are a mixture of unelected bureaucrats representing nations and CEOs, chief executive officers and directors of private companies. A lot of people don't realise the World Health Organization is a private company and largely privately funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They've always had a lot of power over us. That's kind of what Brexit was about in a way. But since March 2020, these global international technocracies have increase their power over us as individuals, as national populations, taking it to another level. And we can see that with the new programs that are being implemented at the moment, which have simply been announced in this country by Rishi Sunak, that he's going to impose unilaterally digital ID and central bank digital currency without any discussion in Parliament, without any discussion pretty much in the media, and certainly with no consultation with us. He hasn't got any electoral mandate at all. He is simply implementing decisions which have been made by these global technocracies. So it's different to what we had in the 30s, but we've still got extraordinarily powerful people imposing things on us outside of any democratic framework or process. Fascism historically arises on two things. Many things, but two fundamental ones. One is a decaying or a declining or a failing democracy. And we've definitely got that. We don't live in a democracy in this country at the moment. And a financial crisis as well. And we've got both of those. I believe fascism is something which is endemic to capitalism. It's not like any other types of tyrannies. It's not merely a dictatorship. It's peculiar to, I think, the European context. And it's the axe blade within this kind of loosely bound carapace we have of law and culture and politics. And when those don't function anymore, the axe comes out. And that's what we're seeing at the moment. We've been beaten with the rods of fascism, this idea of the collective good, for the last 3 years. But the axe is definitely coming out at the moment.
A number of commentators who are fully aware of the tyranny inflicted by governments across the world in the name of a public health emergency have claimed that what we're seeing is a communist takeover in the West. One can understand the possible validity of this claim when we recall that no European country's plans entertain the prospect of putting a nation on pause in the form of lockdown. China, the communist one-party state, then did just that, enacting this innovative invention in pandemic control, which was in actual fact a medieval and barbaric intervention. Professor Ferguson then stated, "We couldn't get away with it in Europe, we thought. And then Italy did it, and we realised we could." Additionally, we had Susan Michie, a member of the British Communist Party, as a key figure of the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, known as SAGE, who were pulling the strings when it came to decisions that curtailed our freedoms. Those commentators went on to opine for the heady days of Western capitalism before the alleged pandemic eroded it all. On the other hand, looking back to the Second World War, we read about how it was a communist Soviet Union that played a dominant role in the liberation of much of Europe from fascism. What do you make of the opinion that what we've been facing is more akin to communism than fascism?
The Soviet Union, definitely under Stalin, became a totalitarian regime. And fascism can become totalitarian. In the Third Reich, that turned into a completely totalitarian regime, one of the worst that's ever been seen, probably the worst. Initially, it didn't, even though Mussolini used the term totalitarian a lot. His idea of the state was that it was a totality. And he says in some of his definitions of it that nothing exists outside of the state, which is kind of very similar to what we're having now. What's going on in China at the moment? I think the latest figure is that there are 100 million people in lockdown at the moment. And you see these kind of appalling so-called quarantine camps, which stretch as far as the eye can see. I think the latest one can hold 18,000 people. These are quite clearly a form of concentration camp. And we saw a lot of those coming up around the world. You know, in Australia, you had those very nicely appointed camps, but they were quarantine camps. And when you entered them, you entered into a state of exception, a kind of a space of emergency, and you had no human rights when you were in those camps. Agamben says that the camp, and this is everything from Guantanamo Bay, I should say, to the well-appointed quarantine camps in Australia, all the kind of converted trailers that they're using in China. It doesn't matter where it's made or what its ostensible use is. The camp is the permanent spatialization of a state of exception. And when you enter into it, your human rights are completely stripped from you and you become this thing, this bare life. And once you're in there, the state has complete control over you. In a way, when we were under lockdown, the entire country became a camp, effectively. China is a kind of a dystopian nightmare place at the moment. It's terrifying. And it's undeniable that the model of lockdown, which it was the first to impose, became a model which was adopted, you know, first by Italy and then by the UK and then the rest of the West. And we know from the kind of that famous interview with Neil Ferguson, the professor at Imperial College London, who was responsible for these kind of outrageous and totally inaccurate predictions of how many people would die if we didn't lock down, even though lockdown had never before been used as a medical measure, not since the medieval period. I mean, he's a first-rate quack, that guy, and he should be arrested. He's probably done more damage than anyone in a very, very long time in history. He said, you know, very explicitly in that famous interview in the Times or the Sunday Times, he said, we didn't think we could do what they did in China because they came out of a very rigid, authoritarian governmental system and a long history of kind of obedience. And he didn't think it would work in the West, but it did work. So it's undeniable China at the moment, whether you think that's communism or not, it's certainly a form of state capitalism. And they do have a totalitarian system of governance and control. They are definitely a model for a lot of the measures and programs we're exporting into the West. Sustainable Development Goals is a form of their social credit system. Their use of the Internet of Things and the Internet of Bodies to control people, you know, their sort of green code they have, where they've done it just recently. We've had these huge protests and they turned the health code, as they call it, of every protester red, which means they simply can't move around the country. So there's a lot of influence of what's coming from China into this. But we're not China in the West. And I don't believe that Bill Gates and Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, or the head of the European Commission, or the heads of the G7, or Klaus Schwab, or all these enormously powerful people who are the kind of the architects who are pushing this coup through, I don't think they're communists. It's quite clear they're not. They're globalists, but they definitely want to create and are creating a totalitarian system of surveillance, control, monitoring, and ultimately of domination. In a way, as I said before, whether this is people want to use the word communist or fascist or so on, these terms are sort of, they're redundant in a way. There's a new world emerging at the moment. And the distinction is not between left and right. It's between the totalitarian system of control and those who are trying to resist and oppose it.
My understanding about how totalitarian states function is that they need the citizens of such a state to become willing enforcers of the ideologies which underpin that system of governance. This was clearly evident during the Nazi reign of terror in Germany and beyond, where a significant proportion of the citizenry became complicit in Nazi activities at some level, such as becoming informants or even taking part in Jewish boycotts. In other words, the Nazis couldn't have met their objectives without relying on a network of such collaborators. Can you elaborate on the term totalitarianism and how the ideology is being implemented in the current global biosecurity state?
I think the book that I was kind of, which helped me very much to understand what was going on, is the book by Hannah Arendt, the German political theorist who was herself an escapee from the Third Reich. I think she died in the 80s, but in 1951 she published a book called The Origins of Totalitarianism. And she's very insistent that totalitarianism is different from simply dictatorship or tyranny or indeed from fascism. She sees it as a novel form of government which was produced in the 20th century and certainly wasn't finished with the overthrow of the Third Reich or even with the death of Stalin. She sees it as something which is a constant threat to the modern state. And I think she's right. I don't think there's many people, kind of, as it were, who are aware of what's going on, who would be reluctant to use the word totalitarianism. I think when you see, just the other day, you had Emmanuel Macron, who is a horrible little man who was kind of mutilated and attacked his own people for years in the Gilets Jaunes protests. A criminal by any definition of the term, saying quite openly what we need is a one world government. You know, they're talking in these terms now. They're talking in very explicit totalitarian terms. To try and answer your question, Arendt says there are four characteristics of totalitarianism which make it different from any other kind of political or governmental system. One is its obedience to a higher authority, which is absolutely unassailable. We tend to think of totalitarianism perhaps as being, you know, this great leader Hitler or this great leader Stalin, great in the sense of their power and their absolute authority. And she says, no, that's what Mussolini was and that's what Franco was or something, or any dictator like Pinochet or, you know, all the kind of the tin pot dictators around the world. She says, yes, they had very strong leaders who seemed to be unassailable, but they were merely the embodiment of a higher idea. For the Third Reich, the higher idea was race. This idea of a pure race. For Stalinism, it was the idea of class, that there were kind of classes which were progressive and classes which weren't. And that kind of justified things like the, you know, the famines in the Ukraine or something like that. You know. Our higher authority is science. Follow the science. Again and again, we're told, and it's used not just by the COVID faithful, it's now used by the environmental fundamentalists as well. They say the same thing. Follow the science. Science is fundamentally about questioning. Science is a set of discursive procedures which demand empirical validation through a repeated test, if you like, a set of experiments which can be demonstrated over and over again. It is not this apotheosized truth. It is the opposite of that. Science has become our religion now. So that's one thing, a higher idea, a higher authority, which is unquestionable. The other one is the rule of terror. And I think COVID was... We've had it for a long time, but COVID moment was one of terror. It was literally a period of terror. We kind of discussed that earlier on. It terrified people. The government was a terrorist and is still. But we're seeing the same thing used with the environmental fundamentalists. They're constantly terrorizing us. You know, these kids that we see going with sort of Just Stop Oil and stuff like that. I don't think they're faking it. I always say that the best salesman is the salesman who believes in their product. And they do believe that the end of the world is nigh. They don't realise that they've been told this for the last 50 years and that end of the world always needs to be going back. So, but they are genuinely terrified. They've been terrorised into compliance. Terror breeds compliance, enforces compliance. And when people really believe that we're facing the end of the world, whether that's from an environmental catastrophe or from a terrible new disease which is going to wipe out the planet, you know, it's called civilization threatening, they obey. So that's the other thing. The third one is probably the one which is most interesting to me, and that is the use of what Arendt calls ideological thinking. Ideological thinking is how these ideas control people's behaviour. Terror can say, don't do this, don't leave your house, because if you do, you'll spread this terrible disease. Or it says, don't eat meat, because the breeding of meat and animals is destroying the world. But she was like, how do you turn that into a way of actually not stopping people doing things, but actually making them do things. Kind of what we said before about the use of biopower. It's not simply a law saying you can't do this. How can we actually control what people do? How can we literally control how they think, how they behave, how they interact, what they do? And she says, ideological thinking is a way of not thinking. It's a way of making deductions from a first premise. If you have a first premise, that is, man-made climate change is threatening to destroy the world in 10 years. From that, you can make a series of deductions, which brings you down to the point where you say you have to eat insects. Or, I was thinking the other day, my book might not be able to be printed in a year or two, because they'll say cutting down forests to make paper is destroying the world. So the only books you can have are online books, and we can control what's on there. Of course, what they're actually doing is saying, you can't print a book that we don't have absolute control over. So once you've got these first premises in action, the other one we were told is COVID-19 is a brand new, unprecedented disease, which is going to wipe out its civilization threatening. Those are the words they use. And therefore, we're going to lock you down. Then we're going to force you to wear a mask all the time. Eventually, we're going to make you forcibly take an injection or an experimental biotechnology. And if you don't, you're going to lose all citizenship. So from a first unexamined premise, once people accept that, you can justify any form of tyranny and any form of control. And we've seen that used in the invented health threat, public health threat of COVID, which was never a public health threat. It was a threat purely to people who were elderly and in most cases had a pre-existing threatening disease. We've seen it in the environmental fundamentalists who want to completely transform our world on the justification that we're all going to be dead in 10 years if we don't. And we're seeing it again with, you know, today you had Hunt telling us that we're all going to have to change our behaviours. Interesting term. Not what we can't do, but we're going to actually have to change our behaviour towards how much energy we consume, how we heat our home, what food we eat, in order to defeat the Ukraine or to defeat Russia in the Ukraine. And it's utterly ludicrous. But it's very interesting that these people are speaking in very open terms about not what we cannot do, what is illegal or illegal. They want to change our behaviour. They want to change everything about us. That's biopower. It's about manipulating people. And the way you do that is not through laws that come down and tell you what you can and cannot do. It's about changing the way that people think, the way they behave, the way they interact with each other.
The behaviour changes that took place prior to the alleged pandemic were the ones that enabled the state to wreak the havoc it did over the past 3 years and get people to comply. The kind of behaviours we see at airports in the name of safety following 9/11, such as removal of shoes when passing through airport security, and not being able to carry liquids over 100 millilitres in your hand luggage, are examples of how our behaviours have changed. The biggest behaviour changes are being imposed on children. Whilst all staff at the Department of Education were maskless, children in schools were forced to wear face coverings for up to 8 hours a day. Few adults were allowed on school premises, and the pupils had to take twice weekly tests for a year, often being sent home on the back of false positives, that led them to believe they were toxic disease bags who could harm granny unless they locked themselves in their rooms for 2 weeks. The use of fingerprints and biometric data to purchase school meals is another example of behaviour changes underway in schools. Children were made to stand in circles, 2 metres apart from each other, in the freezing cold because adult teachers meant to be looking after them feared for their own safety. Pupils were put into bubbles and made to wear lanyards around their necks like products on a supermarket shelf. The launch of behaviour management softwares such as Class Charts, which logs pupils' visits to the toilet or the medical room, is a prime example of how quickly the fabric of our children's lives is being altered. Above all, though, the rise of the internet has led to many of the aforementioned behaviours being put in place. Mankind doesn't know it yet, but the best thing that could ever happen to our children and grandchildren is to have the internet shut down and let everybody remember what it's like to be kind, down-to-earth, small community families again. The campaign of fear and terror waged by the globalist technocracies would have had far less reach on our behaviours without it.
After 9/11, the US imposed the security state. It didn't have that prefix bio yet, but it was called the security state. I lived over in the US for a couple of years, and My partner at the time was working with someone who was doing private airlines. And she said, all those security measures, the taking off the shoes, the taking off the belt, all the scans and the measures and the blah, blah, blah. If you're rich and you get a ticket, all that's gone. It wasn't just a fabrication. It wasn't merely to make people scared all the time. It was, as you say, habituating people to types of behaviours and practices which made them compliant. I remember the first time I came back into the UK with my passport and I realised they were doing a retinal scan of me. And I kept on closing my eyes and I couldn't get through because every time they scanned me, I closed my eyes. And I thought, they haven't even mentioned, they haven't said we're going to do a retinal scan of you. But by that time, the passports had changed to that digital image of us rather than simply a passport photo, which you and I could remember. And I had real trouble getting into the country again because they kept on saying, open your eyes. And I went, no, I'm not going to allow you to do a retinal scan of me. Why is there not a big sign up here saying we're doing a retinal scan of you? And I think I had a glitch in my passport as well. It didn't kind of match up and stuff like that. So I was having all sorts of troubles getting back into my own country, as it were. But I was appalled at, you know, there's the sort of the cattle grids that they make you go through. They've been, yes, habituating us to types of behaviour that you and I, our generation, would have believed unbelievable 20 years ago. Absolutely unbelievable. Well, it's not 20 years ago. It's before 20 years ago because the security state came in after 9/11. That's what it justified.
There was a time, not so long ago, when most of the public were up in arms about the introduction of powers given to the police to take and store DNA profiles from mouth swabs of suspects who were later not charged or who were subsequently acquitted of any wrongdoing. By 2007, the power of the police in the UK to take DNA samples from any arrested individual without requiring their assent was unrivalled in the world, but there was still a great deal of opposition to the practice. Yet here we are in the present day, where plenty of the public religiously take DNA swab tests out of an unfounded fear of catching the disease known as COVID and then hand these over to the authority. Some have even become hypochondriacs. People also seem to have forgotten the wearing of blue surgical masks by the uncharged detainees at Guantanamo Bay, clearly not for health reasons, only as recently as 2003. People have very short memories. I'd like to ask you about something you said in your book. You wrote that the lockdowns imposed across the world were necessitated by a barely reported global financial crisis that hit in September 2019. Why was there a need for a lockdown, and how might that have benefited those implementing such measures on the back of a financial crash?
Now, I've been trying to address this recently. I have from the start, because as I said before, you know, because people say, well, if this is intentional, how would a government benefit from destroying its own economy? That seems crazy. Governments spend most of their time, we're usually criticising governments, saying, you don't care about the people. All you care about is, you know, making the economy as productive as possible. But that means all the money going into the sort of fewer and fewer hands, blah, 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 blah. At the moment, it seems very apparent that national governments, not just the UK, but across the West, are deliberately managing the decline of their own economies. This kind of parallels with this, with what we saw as housing campaigners. When a council estate, so maybe 1,000 homes, something like that, was targeted for demolition and redevelopment as market scale homes, the councils would, over a period of years, oversee its managed decline. That would entail stopping taking out the rubbish so the place became a tip, stop conducting any repairs on the building. When someone had a leak, they would simply leave it for months on end. Then when people began to move away, they would bring people with troubled backgrounds onto the estate and put them in the vacated homes. So the community became broken up as well. People saying, I've been around my neighbours for years, we all get on, we've learned to live with each other. Suddenly there's someone coming in here who's got a background in crime or whatever, any sort of problem. And it breaks up the community and stuff. And it's a deliberate process which is used to clear the ground for people willing to then take the kind of tiny little compensation they're given to break up that community, clear away the ground, and then you can demolish the homes and build something. And I was thinking the parallels between that and what's been going on now. We are deliberately breaking up our communities. We are deliberately, we, the governments and the people behind it, are deliberately bankrupting. I was looking at the statistics on bankruptcies. They're the highest that they've been at the moment since 2009, which of course happened after the last financial crisis. that of 2008, 2009. And people ask, well, how can that benefit people? The analogy that I've been using is to look at what happened in Russia after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. So in the early 1990s, within 10 years, the Russian gross domestic product had dropped to 40% of what it had been before. Can you imagine? You have to remember, the Soviet Union was one of two great superpowers at the time. And within a decade, Russia, which was, of course, the heart of that union, was calling for an international aid because it was worried people were starving. We're quite not that level yet. But, of course, what happened, what emerged out of that was this oligarchy of a mixture of businessmen, gangsters, mafia, what we call oligarchs. It's kind of a derogatory term because we call our oligarchs entrepreneurs and global investors and philanthropists and things like that. But they're the same people doing the same thing. They're the people who know how the world works financially. They're financial wizards, if you like. And what we're seeing already is that during lockdown, there was an enormous outsourcing of the functions, the services of the state to huge international companies like Serco. It's one of those famous ones, or Optiva and stuff. What we're also seeing at the moment now is that the authority of the estate is being handed over to private companies. For instance, what now is and is not freedom of speech, what can be said online, is now being handed over to not our law courts, not our parliament, not our elected representatives, but to private information technology companies and social media platforms. So there's two things going on. On the one hand, as you impoverish a nation, as you bankrupt its businesses, as you lose jobs and you change the nature of jobs as well, the market share of those small companies gets taken up, gets gobbled up, eaten up by monopolies, international monopolies. And we're seeing that happening. It's been going on for a long time. That's the heart of what neoliberalism is, but it's jumped in a great, great way. But perhaps the more important thing that's happening now is the power, if you like, the political power is being concentrated in more and more private hands, these international technocracies I was talking about, who operate outside of any kind of democratic accountability. They're transnational organisations. They are forming a global form of governance. And we've got absolutely no way of voting them in or out or controlling what they do. And when they tell our nations to implement something, we've got very few democratic recourses, none at all, actually, to say whether we approve or not. We can vote out our government after 4 years, by which time it's been implemented. But since the only opposition we've got are, if anything, even more fervently implementing the same measures, we, as someone said to me today, we live in a one-party state. There's two parties, or there's several parties, but they're all doing the same thing. What is fascism? One of the definitions of fascism is it is a one-party state. We have the facade of democracy. Our democracy doesn't exist anymore because there is no alternative. It's a power grab as well as a economic grab. As happened in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union, both political power and economic power is being concentrated in fewer hands and in private hands outside of what the state used to be. I think there's a lot of similarities between after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Boris Yeltsin, remember the big blonde kind of shambling drunken figure with his kind of vodka, was kind of appointed to take over, and his re-election was funded by the oligarchs. In return, he basically allowed them to buy up all the industries in Russia, the oil, the petroleum, the steel, the uranium and everything. But then when he died, they appointed our old friend Vladimir Putin. He was their choice. We've got a kind of a similar thing here. We've had the big shambling, also called Boris Johnson, who's kind of this dangerous fool who basically implemented the first stage of the UK biosecurity state on the justification of responding to this kind of, you know, fictional disease. But he's been replaced, or he's been followed by, his successor has been appointed by who? Rishi Sunak was not elected by his party. He certainly wasn't elected by the electorate. Parliament had nothing to do with it. He simply was appointed. Who appointed him? Who decided he was going to be our prime minister? What we do know is he's pushing forward unilaterally, outside of any mandate or democratic accountability, with programs and technologies which are going to fundamentally change the social contract in this country as it is across the West. So I think there's very big parallels between Rishi Sunak and Vladimir Putin in a very strange way. They are the fronts for the oligarchs, or what we call entrepreneurs.
There are some who believe that the technocratic order wishes to impoverish us and change the nature of employment, instead turning to technologies in order to carry out much of the work human beings currently engage in. This, according to the sinister historian Yuval Harari, who is closely associated with the World Economic Forum, would lead to a human class of useless eaters. This has led to others who are convinced that with all the harmful medical interventions such as lockdown, lack of medical treatment, DNRs placed on the elderly and vulnerable, and COVID injections being rolled out on the double at warp speed, those in power wish to significantly engineer a depopulation agenda in order to make it easier to manage a small number of people whilst laying claim to greater resources for themselves. How realistic is the depopulation agenda in your opinion?
Before I started writing my book, I kind of ended my last stage of articles on a three-part, quite large, it was about 100 odd pages or something, on looking at the UK vaccination programme, vaccination in inverted commas, because they're not vaccines. They didn't do anything the vaccines do. They're not made as vaccines. They're experimental biotechnology. They're experimental because the trials are not due to finish for a long time. They're using new technology, most of them using this mRNA, messenger RNA biotechnology. At the beginning, I thought I didn't have really a view, or I didn't want to sort of say a view about what I thought they were doing. I thought they'd been made so quickly that the obvious dangers they had, that the injuries, which in this country alone are well over 1 million, 1.5, probably 2 million by now, and that's which are the documented ones, serious injuries, and the thousands of deaths that they were causing, that was a result of simply sort of the slapdash nature of their production. They'd kind of been brought in because there was a chance to make billions and billions of dollars by Pfizer and AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson, all the other people, Moderna and so on. The new data that's kind of emerging at the moment and the concerns of more and more doctors and scientists, they've got more access to what these things are doing. And it seems that in a lot of cases, there's going to be sort of permanent damage to the immune systems. It's not just about blood clotting, the rise in heart attacks in young people, which are terrible enough, but it seems that the immune systems of people who have been injected repeatedly by these experimental biotechnology are being sort of destroyed. I didn't really want to go this idea of a depopulation agenda. It's looking more possible. It's certainly not looking impossible. It's looking more and more likely. And again, as you say, when you hear the very express statements by Klaus Schwab, by this guy whose name I can't remember, they're talking very openly about Bill Gates, about depopulation. And when you hear them using this phrase, useless people, that was a term used by the Nazis, useless mouths, about people who couldn't serve the state, who would therefore simply be killed off, either in camps or through their involuntary euthanasia programme. Yeah, I think the people that we're dealing with, that's well within their capabilities, both politically, technically, and morally, if you like, ethically. I don't think they have any problem whatsoever in implementing such a programme. Whether it is that's the case, or whether it's simply because they didn't really care about rushing these experimental vaccines, we'll see.
I'd like to revisit the economics of lockdown. In your book, you quoted Fabio Vigi, professor of critical theory and Italian at Cardiff University, who said, "The stock market did not collapse in March 2020 because lockdowns had to be imposed. Rather, lockdowns had to be imposed because financial markets were collapsing." Why did the real economy of most business transactions and consumer spending need to be shut down in order to protect it from the vast sums of money being pumped into the failing financial sector? All the shutdown did was enrich the already wealthy elite and destroy the livelihoods and businesses of countless people, sending at least 500 million people worldwide into dire poverty. Where is the logic in that from the point of view of those in the real economy? What would have happened to the real economy had lockdown not been imposed to protect us from a virus, but from an apparent economic meltdown? Clearly, that wouldn't have benefited the elites either.
Funny enough, today I was reading through an old article because I'm re-editing some stuff, and there was an article in the New Left Review, strangely. I wasn't writing about this positively. I was talking about how the left has kind of completely collaborated with all this. And this is kind of an early, this is in kind of mid or to the end of 2020. And they pointed out that this huge increase in quantitative easing, that is when banks make loans, the amount that they give up on a loan, they also add to their own assets as well. So basically you're increasing the amount of money, as it were, in circulation. And I thought, yeah, people recognised it even then. What's extraordinary about this is that it was the second global financial crisis in the West, well, it's global really, in 12 years since the last one, which began in sort of 2007, 2008. And almost nobody's written about it. Most people don't even know it happened. Whereas we all knew about the 2008 one, didn't we? We knew about the subprime mortgage crisis and how that went into the financial crisis. In June 2019, the Bank of International Settlements, which was founded after the Great War, it's the central bank of all central banks. It has ultimate jurisdiction, as it were, over monetary policy. And it published its annual report, this is in June 2019, before anyone had heard of coronavirus disease or COVID, saying it was too good to be true. That is, the it was the recovery from the last financial crisis. And it predicted that, it said global markets are jittery, and it predicted another crisis coming very, very soon. In July, maybe the next month or August, the BlackRock. Now, BlackRock is a immensely powerful financial, it's an asset manager. And together with, what is it, State Street and who is it, the other one? I don't know, there's three of them. These three asset managers have, on average, I think they control 20% of shares of the 500 most powerful companies in the world on the New York Stock Exchange. And they're the ones who are setting environmental, social and corporate governance criteria. They're very, very, very powerful organizations, and they're completely private. The CEO of BlackRock is called Larry Fink. You'll see him talking at the World Economic Forum all the time. They produced a report in anticipation of this financial crisis, advising that the way to do this was through unprecedented monetary policy. And their monetary policy was that when the next financial crisis comes, they had to inject vast quantities of electronic money, so not real money, electronic money, quantitative easing, into the financial sector, so commercial banks who were failing. Commercial banks who couldn't pay off the interest on their loans and blah, 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 all that sort of stuff.
In other words, bailing out the banks again and basically saving that lot.
Saving that lot. But at the same time, they said, we can print all the money in the world. We live in a fiat economy, if you like. You can just invent money. You just add another zero. You sort of go, boom, and there it goes. But the trouble is, if that money goes into the real economy, the retail economy of loans and buying and selling and blah, 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 the business world, the real economy that we think is the real one out there, you're going to get vast inflation. If you increase the amount of money in circulation, of course, the value of that money is going to drop down hugely. And they actually cited the last time this happened in a really, really bad way. It happened in Argentina, but it happened in the Weimar period in Germany. And it was that that laid the ground to the rise of fascism, the rise of the Third Reich. It's kind of strange that BlackRock are actually citing this period in history as a warning of what could happen unless they controlled what happened to this money. So they said, we have to come up with unprecedented measures. First of all, we have to pump vast quantities of money into the collapsing financial sector, but we need to protect the real economy. So that money goes to the banks, it bails them out, but that money doesn't then go into the real economy. How are you going to do that, though? Anyway, in September 2019, the repo market, the repurchase agreement market, which really rose to its current size and influence after the last financial crisis, is where someone makes a loan of liquidity, which is then paid back the very next day or within a couple of weeks or something like that at a greater rate. It's a very fluid sort of market. Some hedge funds have been getting into this, and basically a lot of banks began to pull out of it, and interest rates on this sort of rocketed from sort of 2% to 10% in a matter of hours. You think, why is that important? If you think that there's $4.1 trillion in that market and interest rates go from 2 to 10%, that's a real problem. This happened. This was the financial crisis, or the triggering of it, which was anticipated by the Bank of International Settlements and by BlackRock. The next month, all the G7 members in, was it, October, they all got together, the heads of the central banks of the G7 nations, met in the US and they decided to implement BlackRock's suggestions. Over the next 6 months, the US Federal Reserve, so the central bank system of the US, pumped over $11 trillion. Trillion's a very strange, there's a billion is 1,000 million. This is a million. It's a vast amount of money. And they pumped that into the collapsing financial sector. And they made no requirements, apart from verbally, of what this money had to do. They kind of said at the time, oh, we're doing this because we need to support the economy under lockdown. We need to kind of, you know, pay for furlough. We need to pay for keeping businesses alive and stuff like that. But that money didn't go into those businesses and it didn't go into furlough. A little bit of it did. Most of it went into propping up this collapsing financial sector. That was okay as far as it went. But when you started to open up the economy again, which was 2 years later, remember they said the Coronavirus Act in this country was exactly 2 years. And at the time, everyone said, why is it going for 2 years? We don't even know what this disease is. Surely it's going to be over by then. Surely the virus would have been either contained or become, you know, endemic and something. Why is it exactly 2 years? And lo and behold, exactly 2 years later, they started lifting the restrictions and opening up the economy. As that happened, and if you look at the interest rates in this country, they opened up in March. A couple of months later, the interest rates go up and up and up. Now, at the moment, I think interest rates in this country are, I think they're about 11%. They're predicted at the early next year to go up to 13%, but there are some people think it might go up to 18%. We have spiraling inflation, like which we haven't seen for a very, very long time, not since the 70s. You know, I like to go onto YouTube and listen to hedge fund managers, not conspiracy theorists, who talk about what's happening. And they said, we're at the end of a cycle of debt, which began in the 70s, when the US dollar was taken off the gold standard. And finance basically became a religion. It became about credit, and credit is about belief. And it's all collapsed. And that money, which was pumped, that $11 trillion, that's just in the US Federal Reserve, but around the world, the Bank of England, the Central Bank of Europe, Central Bank of Japan, the Central Bank of China, collectively, their assets went from something like $19 trillion to $31 trillion. So they've created this vast cloud of quantitative easing. And that money is now going into the economy and it's creating this spiraling inflation that we've got at the moment. We've added to that by starting a war or starting sanctions, imposing economic sanctions on Europe's, you know, the biggest exporter of petroleum and oil in the world. You've got China, the biggest exporter of goods and, you know, kind of services in the globe, who's got the entire country under a kind of a permanent lockdown with its medically meaningless zero COVID policy. So there is a real perfect storm of a failing capitalism at the moment.
Who benefits from a failing capitalism?
Who's benefiting from this? We're being told, not only by people like Jeremy Hunt, but much more powerful people, more influential, that we need to change our patterns. Energy consumption needs to go down, ostensibly to save the planet. What I've called this in my book is, this is definitely not a response to a disease, but it's not a response even to the end of the world with this climate catastrophe. Western capitalism is going through a revolution, a huge revolution, into some other form. And it's going into a form of global governance. And our standard of living is going to go, has already gone down, is going to go right down. It's partly about the West losing its preeminence as well, I think, in the world. And the people in the West want to hold on to their aspect of power as much as they can.
You stated earlier that the entire alleged coronavirus pandemic was a manufactured crisis. To what extent was the crisis manufactured? Are you questioning the very nature and existence of viruses as these contagious, exogenous, disease-causing agents?
I can't really make statements on that. I'm not a doctor or a scientist, or definitely not an epidemiologist. So the questions that people say about, well, does this actually exist? Has the DNA sequencing been done? Is there an actual virus? I know that I myself have been sick several times with something which felt like a very bad flu. And under the protocols for testing, I was identified as having coronavirus and so on. It doesn't really matter what it's called. When I say that it's been a manufactured crisis, I mean the crisis that was made, which justified this assault on our civilization, on our democracy, on our rights, all the things that we've been talking about, that became the justification for the implementation of this brand new normal, as they call it. They started calling that right early on, didn't they? They said, we're going to build back better to a brand new normal. The crisis barely happened. That crisis has been manufactured. The rise in deaths, which were quite small, actually, in 2020, I think it was the 12th highest since 1942. It was definitely not this terrible spike in deaths. Most of those deaths, in my analysis, were caused by the deaths in care homes, of which there are multiple causes, one of which was 70% of people in care homes in this country suffer from dementia. And when you put people with dementia in their own room, and you lock them away for months on end, and you put them a TV in front of them, and you terrorise them, and doctors are too scared to actually go into them, and you ban them from seeing their families, they will die. And they did die in huge numbers. So the deaths, which contributed to the slight rise in overall mortality, were primarily caused, not by this brand new virus or the disease, but by lockdown measures itself, which restricted radically for months on end, years on end, really, the access of 68 million people in this country to medical diagnosis and medical care. And particularly the lack of diagnosis for cancers, treatment for heart disease, and of course the terrible conditions we created for people suffering dementia has completely unexpectedly created more deaths, which are really coming to fruition now, if I can put it like that. At the moment in this country, the rise in excess deaths over the normal, that is, even those which have not been attributed to COVID-19, and as I said before, the criteria for attributing a death to COVID-19 are almost meaningless, but even those which haven't been are through the roof at the moment. That is the dark fruit of what we planted back in 2020, when we basically withdrew medical treatment for 68 million people for the better part of 2 years. Of course, people are dying in excess numbers now. So what I mean is that that crisis was manufactured. There never was a threat to public health. That is, all of us are a threat to this. If there is this new disease, it's a threat to what people usually are threatened by: seasonal influenza, elderly people, people who already have health problems.
What can we do as individuals in order to prevent the transformation of life on Earth for humanity into a living hell of slavery and absolute control? What is the solution that can help create a truly better and free world?
The UK government is a criminal organisation. I'm sad to say it, but the National Health Service is a criminal organisation. What they're doing is, given the overwhelming evidence of the dangers of these so-called vaccines, the fact that they're still pumping into our children, to all elderly people, to anyone, is a criminal act. It doesn't seem there's much aspect of our civic society at the moment, our civil society, which is not behaving like criminals. The fact that censorship of free speech, a fundamental aspect, if you look at what a definition of a democracy is, it's a fundamental aspect that you have freedom of speech. Don't agree with people, but you don't, you know. And that's just been given up like nothing at the moment. We're living in a criminal society. I think that's the first thing we have to understand. We are now living in a criminal society. So what is our agency in that? I think the first thing is we have to stop thinking that the source of our agency resides in the Houses of Parliament. I believe myself, I have for many years, but particularly now, that Parliament has been so corrupted, that sort of politics is no longer a forum for change. It's not going to change things. So how do we change things? We talked a little bit about if this is a totalitarian system, we're going into one. If it was a totally totalitarian system, you wouldn't be able to make this. So there's still hope. And that's why we need to make these. We need to hold on to things like this. But we're definitely going towards that. We're going to a point where very, very soon, if they don't like what you say, they will simply take away your ability to say it online. And eventually, you know, they're going to change our health code and say, we heard you saying something the other day online, so we're going to take away your ability to move around the country or to get petrol in your car or to get onto a train station or something like that. That's what they're doing in China. And China seems to be where we're sort of following at the moment. So what can we do? If you say to people what we have to do, which is overthrow the criminals in power and develop a new politics and new economics, that's obviously what we have to do. That's a very difficult answer. And it allows people to say, well, I can't do anything. I can't do that. You're talking about revolution and things like that. That's impossible. So it lets people off the hook. So we need a smaller answer, something that people can act on. We were talking about a totalitarian system working when everyone in that system, a whole society, believes in it. It's not a dictatorship. It's not about laws saying what you can and cannot do. It's people themselves changing their behavior, saying, I'm not going to buy books because it kills trees, or I'm not going to eat meat because it's ruining the planet, or I'm going to go out wearing my mask. It's a self-regulatory program. And that relies on ideology, which is different. Ideology is not laws. It's not the police with the truncheon saying, you must do that. It's about the way we think and behave and interact with each other. And we've still got access to that. There's still a world which is not completely taken over by the media and by Parliament, or by the judiciary, or by the police, or by the secret services, or by the kind of the technologies that they use to survey us and monitor us and control us. We still have this thing called human interaction. We need to always interact with each other physically and humanly as we can. The other day I went into a shop and there's a woman sitting there behind it was a local Tesco's, which I hate, and she's sitting behind a plastic screen, an acetate screen. And I'm not giving her a hard time, but she's sitting there serving me. And I said, you do know that the coronavirus is 1/1000 of a millimeter thick. And I can afflict this thing. And I said, the only thing this is protecting you from is our common humanity. We need to keep being human. We need to keep challenging this ideology whenever we can and as many times as we can. We've got something on our side. There's a good thing to end on. We've got something on our side. The vision of the future, which is being promoted to us, which is being sold to us by the WEF, by Rishi Sunak, by the environmental fundamentalists, by these messianic end-of-the-world catastrophe kind of predictors, by these kind of religious nutters, really, who are kind of saying the end of the world is nigh, which is what religion always sort of says in a way, for organised religion. And he says the end of the world is nigh unless you do what we say. The vision they're promoting of the future, of total control, of a single global system in which every aspect of our lives is monitored, in which we are allowing biotechnology to enter into our hands. You know, people want to have chips or even injected into their brains or whatever. That's a dark dystopian future. And I think only perhaps children who've been raised by their smartphones could ever see that as being something they want to have. Convenience breeds compliance. The rest of us know that that is not a future that we want. It's a terrifying future. Because we've seen other people in history, in recent history, predict and try to take us into futures like that. That's their weakness. No matter how much they try to dress it up in idiot phrases like, you will own nothing and be happy. We know what happens when you own nothing. You're definitely not happy. You're at the complete mercy of the state and of global capital. They can come in and completely control you. So we need to propose and enact in our interactions with each other every day, a different type of future, which is a human future. Because the globalist coup is a fundamentally transhuman agenda. It's about making, and this is something Hannah Arendt said about totalitarianism, the ultimate object of totalitarianism is to make human beings redundant to the system. The system can function on its own without contributions of humans. We are the object of totalitarian control. We are not the subject of it. Totalitarianism wants to eradicate human interaction, human warmth, human thinking, human randomness. Humans are radically random. So we need to be random and we need to be human with each other. That's the best answer I can give at the moment.